So our last speaker today is going to be Dr. Todd. He's a professor in chief of the section of acute care surgery at Baylor College of Medicine. He is also a surgeon for ER doc. We're going to learn a little bit more on why we should not be on social media.
Well, good afternoon. Hopefully this video will work with sound. This is a little clip from a Netflix show Black Mirror. So if you'll humor me for about a minute and a half, this will get us going. So, do you have a sound on? It's better with the sound, trust me.
You want a cookie with that? On the house.
Let me just start that over.
And that's one brush swing. You want a cookie with that? It's on the house.
Sounds awesome.
See you
tomorrow, JJ.
See you, Lacey.
Oh, saw your boy in the fire hat just now. So cute.
Yeah, he's really something.
So more to come on that towards the end of my talk. But when Rohan first reached out and asked me to give this talk, I politely declined and said I'm really not in social media and it's really not in my wheelhouse, and recommended James and some other folks I thought would be fantastic. And then Rohan quickly emailed me back and said, well, maybe you could talk about social media from the older surgeon's perspective. Which I'll admit I took offense to. I don't think Rohan's that much younger than I am, but I said, well, no, Rohan, but if you want me to talk, I'll talk about why I left social media and really never looked back and can argue that I'm better off for it. So I'm really not that anti-social media, but I think this is an interesting perspective. No disclosures. So when you look at social media overall, it is omnipresent, and I agree it's not going anywhere. It's really tough to even figure out what's out there. But when I went the other day and Googled, on Wikipedia, there's 196 major active social media networking sites currently. That doesn't include dating sites. It doesn't include minor sites. Interestingly enough, they had another page with 52 defunct social media sites. So it's obviously not going anywhere. And some interesting tidbits of facts, very similar to what we saw a little bit earlier. But currently, there are 3.03 billion social media accounts. There are 5.5 mean accounts per person, and we as a whole, I really should say you all, spend about 2 hours a day on social media. Every second, you're tweeting 6,000 times per second. And believe it or not, an astounding 95 million photos are uploaded on Instagram per day. Those numbers are pretty astronomical, and you might say, well, that sounds great, Rob. Why wouldn't you want to be involved in this? And in all honesty, I used to be on social media just from a personal perspective. And when I really got off of it was this article I read in ESPN the magazine, and it's called Split Image. And it's a good read, I would recommend, but it's an article about this young girl here, and she was a freshman at Penn, by all rights, she was incredibly successful, had a lot of friends, was a runner on the track team, had a good GPA. And one evening in January of her freshman year, she went to the ninth floor of a parking garage and ran and jumped off that parking garage and committed suicide. And they kind of did a post-mortem in this article about what it was about, and they went back and traced through a lot of her social media accounts and things like that. And it was really one of the drivers. And for me, it kind of resonated with me and made me think about my presence on social media. But one of the statements in that article I think were pretty touching. It said, you look at social media routinely, and you're looking at everybody's filtered life. But for a lot of people, you're still living your life unfiltered. So you don't get to see what everybody's real life looks like. And we're obviously putting a presence out there of what you want people to think about you. And so it kind of made me take pause. And so I kind of stepped back and stepped away from social media pretty much altogether. When I first started looking up this talk, I found this article and this TEDx talk by Cal Newport. And anyone that knows Cal Newport, he's a great author. He's a computer engineer by training, a professor at Georgetown, and he writes pretty thoughtfully on this. But he had this TEDx talk entitled Quit Social Media. And I will encourage you, when this is done, he does it much more eloquently than I do, but it's a 13-minute, 51-second presentation that's absolutely phenomenal on social media and his take on it. But a little bit about my experience. When I got off, and he talks about it, when you get off social media, it is kind of odd. You have some downtime you didn't think about in the past. You're not sure what to do when you get on the internet. And everybody thinks you're kind of crazy, but to be honest, I got off, and believe it or not, I still have friends. Life is still going on. Actually, I still know what's going on in the world. I'm pretty well read, I think. I still collaborate with people around the United States and the world on different projects and stuff. But most importantly, what I'd say is, at the end of the day, and I really do believe this, I think I'm probably happier than I was when I was on social media. And it's interesting, when you read his article and some of our articles, that's what most people say, is they actually feel happier at the end of the day when they're off of it. And I would actually say, and something they all say is, I'd actually say I'm actually probably more successful, both personally and professionally. I have a new dog, I'm recently engaged, life's going great, work's good. So all in all, it's not a bad deal, believe it or not. What Cal Newport talks about, he talks about the three major objections to social media. And I can tell you, I've heard every one of these from friends, from James, from a partner at work, Chad, who has up social media at Baylor in the surgery department. But I'll just go through these three common objections, and I think they're pretty fantastic. The first is, well, social media is a fundamental technology of the 21st century. And the fact is, that's absolutely nonsense. It's really not a fundamental technology at all. It uses some fundamental technologies, but it's not a fundamental technology. It uses technology. If you look into it at the end of the day, and I think anyone who's on social media would agree, it's a source of entertainment. And that's really what social media bears down for most people. It really is a source of entertainment for most folks. The interesting thing is that it's probably somewhat seedy entertainment. And this is where it kind of gets interesting when you read about this, is most social media platforms and companies, they all employ people called intention engineers. And these people, what they do is they actually use the technology from casino gambling, and they try to make social media as addictive as humanly possible. And that's what they do. They keep you on it, and they get you on it. And you know what they're doing the entire time you're on social media? Not to sound crazy, but they're collecting your data, and they're selling it. And that's just the fact. And so you should know that that's what's happening to your data at that point in time. So they want you on social media all day long. That's their goal. And so they actually employ people to make that happen. Second of all, people always sit there and say, well, it's vital to the success in the 21st century. You cannot be successful without social media. And that also, too, is really nonsense. And that's what Newport kind of says. And this latter book of his is called Deep Work. And what he said is, there's a fair amount of work out there that shows that really, in the competitive 21st century, what is valued is things that are rare or valuable. And that's what people are looking for. They want something that's rare and valuable. If you think about social media, any 6-5-year-old with a smartphone can do social media. That's not very rare, and it's sure and very valuable at the end of the day. And there are good data saying that if you have a rare, valuable product, believe it or not, people are gonna find you. Social media may be an adjunct, may help you out, but they're gonna find you. They will seek out and find you. The third one that's, I think, the most compelling is people say it's harmless. And I'll hear this from a lot of people, oh, I really don't post, or I just kind of do this, or I just look at it. It's really not, it's harmless. I don't do much on it. And the fact is, there are a lot of data out there showing that there are significant harms to social media. And it's really kind of interesting when you read into this, but one of the main ones is called fragmented attention. And there are good data on this, and your brain is not meant to process data how that is. So if you think about it, and we've all seen people do it, I was guilty of it at work. You're on work, you look at your Instagram account, you go back to doing some work, then you look at your Facebook, then you go back to this, and you're going back and forth and back and forth. And it causes what they call fragmented attention, and there are very good data coming out now showing that it permanently reduces your capacity to concentrate. So if you think about it, all the stuff you need to be successful in life, concentration, hard work, et cetera, social media is actually making it worse at doing those tasks. So there are pretty good data saying that it actually may have a negative effect. More importantly, and I think most people can resonate with this, are there are true psychological harms, and there are data on this, believe it or not, also. But people who are on social media a lot, they often feel more lonely and isolated. They typically feel inadequate, and they have increased rates of depression. And at the end of the day, that kind of disconcerting in your brain causes what they call a pervasive background hum of anxiety. And he talks a lot about it, about the new generation, watching them come up and see how they handle that. But interesting enough, when you go back to the story from that split image article, that's one of the things she was diagnosed with from her therapist. They said it was just baseline anxiety, and her inability to handle this anxiety is what she was diagnosed with. So those are the three most common objections. There are other articles out there. This is actually one from Bansal and all, and they talk about selfies, and we heard a little about selfies a minute ago. But interestingly enough, when you look at the selfie phenomenon, from 2011 to 2017, there were 259 deaths from people taking selfies. That's pretty harmful, I guess. Death is pretty harmful. But the number one was from falls. Second was from drowning, which I don't really understand that one, but it was the second most common. And the third one was from transportation accidents. And it's interesting, these authors of this article, I kid you not, said that around certain monuments, certain cliffs, there should be selfie-free zones where you're allowed not to take a selfie. I kind of thought the different, but that's me. It's interesting. But so back to the original point I started off with, the Black Mirror article. I think from that video, you're sitting there watching, that can never happen. That's not going to happen. Well, believe it or not, it is already happening in China. Rachel Botsman has this great book called Who You Can Trust, and they took a snippet of it in Wired, and it's called Big Data Meets Big Brother. And this is kind of what's going on. In 2014, the State Council in China developed this plan for the construction of a social credit system. What they determined is that everything you do in life is going to have a value, and it could be what you buy online, if you play games online, how long you're online playing games, your social media accounts, your connectivity, what you post, what your friends post, all this stuff. All those are then lumped in, and basically what they do is say they have negative values or positive values. They take all your negatives and positives, and they distill them to one score, and that's called your credit score, basically, or your citizen score is what they call it. And so everyone has a citizen score. What they're saying is that keeping trust is glorious and breaking trust is horrible or disgraceful. And that's what your credit score is going to determine. The frightful thing is coming in 2020 in China, this is mandatory for every citizen. This is not an option. You're going to have to participate, and that's the end of the discussion. The more frightful concerning thing is if you look at it, it's very similar to the video we saw. You know, this is all going on. You're going to be having these scores. What's really frightful is based on that, you may not be able to fly. They'll slow your internet speeds. You may not get in the best hotels. You might not get a good job. No restaurants. Your kids may be restricted from good schools. On and on and on and on. And this is already out there. You can Google. There are articles of Chinese citizens. There's this one lawyer. He went on a trip, got to get on the train on the way back home, and they wouldn't allow him on the train. Well, come to find out, he had tried a case. The government wasn't happy with him. They told him he had to make a formal apology electronically. He did that. They didn't like his apology, so they wouldn't let him travel anymore via train. True story. I'm not making this stuff up. It's fascinating. So you're all going, that's great. That's China. That'll never happen in the United States. I think you're naive if you think you can't go that far that easily. So if you think about, we already rate restaurants, we rate movies. Every one of us in this room has a rating online of us as doctors that we don't control at all. And it may be based off zero data, quite frankly. And it's still out there, and you don't have any control of it. In 2015, the TSA actually tried to include your social media presence in the pre-check background checks. So they actually wanted to use your social media accounts to determine if you got pre-check. But that was rebuked pretty soundly, so it didn't happen. But this was 3 years ago, mind you. Really what's happening is you're in an entering age where all your actions are going to be judged by standards that you don't control, And you really don't know what those standards are, quite frankly. And I think somebody said on the panel, I can't remember, but once that judgment's out, it's out. It's not going away. So, I mean, I think you have to be very cautious of that. So what I would say is, can you really leave social media? And I'd be curious in the room, if asked by a show of hands, who thinks it would be very easy for you to get off social media? Just raise your hands. So it's interesting, you're probably about 50% of the audience, and that's actually very similar to what the Pew Center looked at. They did a study, and they said, could you give up social media, yes or no? And about 59% said, yeah, it'd be pretty easy to give up, it wouldn't be that hard. Whereas about 40% said, it'd be very hard. The fascinating thing about this is this study was 2018. They asked the exact same question in 2014, and only 28% at that point said it would be hard to give up. So in less than about 4 years, we almost doubled the number of people that think they couldn't give up social media. So it is difficult, I would say. To my colleague's points, they were talking about managing your social media presence. If you want to have a social media presence, there are tons, every one of these is a different app or product or something of that nature that will help you manage your social media account. So it'll help you guide that so you can better manage what it looks like. But what if you're like me and you really just don't want to be involved in it at all? Well, believe it or not, there are now companies out there that can help you manage your lack of a social media presence. So they can actually go out and they'll look for James's fake page about me that he just put up. They'll take it down. If there's salacious or malicious posts about you, they'll take those down. So there are companies out there, if you're really that crazy about this, they would do that for you. I don't really care, so I'm not going to worry about it. But I mean, if you were worried about it, you could actually have a company manage your lack of a social media presence. So in conclusion, what I would say is, it's really not leaving us. I agree completely. It's not going anywhere. I'm not that naive. But I would say you can leave social media if you really want to. And what I would say is in the process, I think you'll be more productive. Trust me, you waste a lot less time when you're not on the social media. You can be equally successful. I would even argue probably more successful. And quite frankly, I think you'll be happier. And I think that's just from a personal experience. But I'll be smart. It's not for everyone. But what I would say is I would encourage everyone in this room that after you leave the Clinical Congress, don't do it this week because Patricia Turner or Dave Hoyt would get really mad at me if I told you to stop tweeting and stop doing all that stuff. So keep doing all that today. But after you leave it, I would say just try to take a week break. Just take a break and see what happens. I think you'll kind of be fascinated. Believe it or not, life keeps going on. Things keep moving. And I guarantee you'll be happier. So thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to the discussion.
So as I was thinking about this session today, I could not have imagined it going any better. It was truly fantastic and engaging. But this is really the time for discussion. So we've got some microphones open over here. Please come up and ask questions. Anyone? Yes, please.
Tanuja Damani from New York. Thank you for very insightful and interesting talks. I just had a question about what you talked about getting out of social media. I feel we at this point are obviously productive, successful, focused, mature surgeons with good judgment. Can we, and I talk to my kids all the time about the harmful effects of social media, but can we use it is there a value in our professional lives? Because I think, I know you talked about a lot of the anxiety and depression and those kind of aspects, but I think we have a very targeted, focused role of social media in our professional lives. I mean, do you see value in that?
Yeah. So I'm going to ask Rob to answer that question, and I guess the question is, can it actually help you?
I mean, I'm honestly not that naive and not that against it. I mean, I think there definitely is some value to it. I'll be honest, it's not for me. It is interesting when you actually really do reading on some of the research, and specifically some of the stuff from Cal Newport. His points are pretty valid. Is it can probably be helpful. That being said, things would probably happen along that line even without it. It might expedite the process. This is my bias. I'd be curious what you think. It might expedite the process. I think if you got rid of it, I think things still keep moving along and everything's just fine is my bias. And that's what the data would support. The more interesting stuff was all the cognitive stuff, which I'll be completely honest, I had no idea of, and that's not why I quit. I had no idea until I started preparing for this talk. But I mean, I think the cognitive data is out there that it probably does have a negative cognitive effect on us. And that, you know, some of the stuff, one of the analogies he uses, it's like a slot machine going to Vegas. You know, when you go to the slot machine occasionally, it's fine. When the slot machine is just sitting at your desk 24/7 and you're going clank, 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 your brain doesn't process that way, and it does have negative effects.
Right. So. And I completely agree with that. I just wanted to know, again, from the professional standpoint, being in an urban market with millennials, I mean,
I think there definitely is. I mean, I'm not going to say you should just get rid of it, but it's not for me.
So Niraj, could you comment on that?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things from my standpoint is I look at my insurance breakdown, and you know, 60% of my patients are Medicare. That they're not really going to be tweeting. Niraj, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree in the sense that there are times when any of us who are, you know, these aficionados have had to step back and say, hey, wait a minute, I gotta focus on my kids or whatever, something not my Twitter handle and not my screen. And I think that's important for everybody to think about that. More pertinent to your question, you know, clearly I agree that there are professional benefits, but I think you can do it in a measured way and not be involved. And quite honestly, you can outsource it to your, you know, if you want to. If you're not interested like I am in doing it yourself, then have your department hire somebody to write a profile for you and, you know, put up a great story about you. You get the same benefit without you having to do all of that stuff too. So there are ways to manage it without being mindful of some of the negative effects. And I think they're very valid, a lot of the points Dr. Todd brought up.
Dr. Disanaika?
So I also wanted to say to that, that, you know, if you're aiming for patients, it's a very different, thank you, it's a very different form that you would use than if you're connecting on Twitter with your colleagues here in the room and here at the Congress. Each forum is made for a different thing, and so if you're going to use it seriously to advance your career, then you do need to talk with people a little bit and figure out who are you trying to get in front of, what are you trying to do. And then I do think you need to put some boundaries so that it doesn't take over your life, honestly. I mean, it does suck you in. It's designed to do that. And so, for example, there are times where I'll say, okay, I'm only going to get on twice for 30 minutes for today, and that's it. And you do have to set your own boundaries. And I think most of us that use these media do that, because otherwise, yeah, it is designed to suck you in and take over your life, really.
And our next question.
Hi. I'm from Rhode Island, Community General Surgery. This has just recently come up for me. I'm doing my thing, doing a procedure. The patient says, can I take a video of this? Can I have a cell-free zone in my exam room? Or how do you handle that? If they say, can I take a picture of this? I'm uncomfortable with that, because you've already discussed how once it's out there, you have no control over it. So how would you address that?
So Dr. Solovic, how about you tell us what you'll
do? Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for me to have patients that want to record the conversations I have with them regarding, you know, shared decision making on are they going to have a thyroidectomy for the indeterminate thyroid nodule or not. Happens very frequently. I have not had a patient say, I want to video record my surgery. Haven't had anybody tell me that. I have had patients ask to take pictures with me in the clinic and all that kind of stuff. I don't have a problem doing that. I think it's surgeon specific. If you don't feel comfortable with it, you can simply reply, it's a pleasure taking care of you. I'm really not comfortable with that, but I'm here to take the best care of you possible. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. I think it's all about that individual decision and what you are comfortable with.
Let me ask Dr. Pitt what your thoughts are.
I think my thoughts are very similar, because I've had experiences where I've either FaceTime people into a consultation, or, you know, I have a patient that comes every year just to take a selfie with me. I'm pretty sure that's the only reason why he comes back. You know, but I think it's that comfort line, right? So if I'm not comfortable with something, then I'm not performing my usual self, whether I'm speaking or operating or whatever it is. So I think that setting that boundary is important.
Great, thank you. Next question.
Yes, Charles Thompson, Long Island, New York. So I think in the medical industry, meaning specifically us care providers, we're always the very last to adapt and to change, because we're so beholden to this dogma, in this case, surgical dogma and medical dogma, that we're the last to change out of all industries. And I think we've fallen behind in several respects because of that. I think social media is one of those things. You said it's easy, you don't deal with social media, and I agree from a personal perspective. But from a business and advertising perspective, social media, in my opinion, is 100% necessary. So I think we should separate the use of social media from a business perspective and social media use from a personal perspective. That was just a comment. My question is, how do we know what the right amount of, or the appropriate amount of content that we post is? On one end of the spectrum, you have surgeons who don't post anything. On the other end of the spectrum, we have surgeons like the one that was reprimanded in Atlanta dancing in the operating room. And in the middle somewhere, we have Dr. Pimple Popper. So, how do we know? Should we just use it or leave it up to our own judgment what's appropriate to post and when to post it?
So thank you for that question. So Dr. Dissanayake, what it really comes down to, what are the ethics around this?
So I've just got to say that the dancing doctor was not a surgeon. I've got to get that clear.
Sorry.
She was not a surgeon.
Okay.
She was doing surgery, and that's a whole different problem. So clearly there were bigger problems in the dancing. So it goes back to the same standards of ethics and professionalism you would do, because I would say that the dancing doctor's problem is not that she was posting too much, it's what exactly she was doing in the OR in the first place. Whether or not she posted that was a ridiculous scenario and needed to be stopped. So I would say that there is no volume barrier, and there are some of us that are prolific and some of us that are very, once in a while we'll put something in the whole gamut. Again, I think it comes to a comfort thing, because we have to recognize, just like a medication, there's a dose response effect. And if you're doing it all the time, you probably are maybe not doing something else that's more productive, right? Because you only have a limited number of hours in the day. And so I think if you're posting something that's educational, that's useful to your peers, useful to patients, go ahead. There's no upper limit. If you're posting things that are using your patients as entertainment, and that's happened, where people make basically fun of your patients or you're swanning around the OR, clowning it up, then you're violating several basic ethical principles that existed long before social media. All you're doing now is you're recording it, making it public so people can catch you. So, it is what it is. The actual action hasn't changed one way or the other. So I would say there's no really volume response. It's just that the same principles apply whether you tape something or you don't. It just, social media hasn't changed the rules. It has simply made it so that everyone now knows what you're doing. And if you break the rules, the whole world knows. That's the only thing that's changed.
So that brings up a really interesting point, because you separated professional from personal. And one of the things that, in marriage, my phone goes off and I always feel like whatever is being texted, my wife should be able to pick up that phone and read it, right? And that's sort of a good little ground rule for me, that whatever I text or tweet, email, that somebody should be able to read without an issue. And sometimes that's my 18-year-old daughter, which I have to be, that has to be okay. So just one little thing from my standpoint. Next, thank you for the question. Next question.
Hi, Mauricio Sierra from Mexico City. Thank you for a fantastic discussion. I think we heard both sides, and although I think social media can be empowering, and we've seen that in the I Look Like a Surgeon movement a couple of years ago, I can certainly relate to how, especially in Latin America, social media is not used responsibly. So it's a very thin line in Latin America and how we are using, as surgeons, as an interactive tool, social media. I wanted to ask any of you, what do you think about social media as a training tool? I tried a couple of courses with my residents in general surgery, and although we talk about them as the millennials and videos would seem the ideal form of communication with them, they did not engage, they did not like the courses, and the response was really, really poor. So I would like your opinion on that.
So,
yes, okay. James.
So one thing that I do is I have a lockdown YouTube channel that's private. That when we go in to do a thyroidectomy, I've got a 3-minute. Here's the 5 fundamental steps that we're going to go through in this operation, and I use that on my phone to go over that with my resident. If the residents are just changing, I've got a brand new resident on who hasn't operated with me before. So it is absolutely a valuable teaching adjunct in terms of video content and steps, technical steps of an operation. that pre-brief, and then coming out of the operating room, that debrief, do you remember these steps? How did it look to you in real life? I think that that's a really great use of video content and YouTube as a social media mechanism for teaching. But like you said, it's also very challenging if you're just gonna hold an event, live stream it across this or that, it may not pick up. So it's all about how you use it. But that's a concrete example of how I've effectively integrated it into our teaching program.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Yes, next question.
Hello, my name is Vamsi Arabindi, a resident at the Baylor College of Medicine. Thank you all for a wonderful panel. My question was about how to use social media in terms of, discussion of academic papers. I know I've learned a lot from basically looking at the Twitters back and forth over various papers that have come out. I mean, Ruboa has been, of course, the papers have been discussed to death in the EM foam community. So do you all ever look at the tweets, so to speak, about academic papers and the discussion?
So I'm going to ask somebody not from Baylor College of Medicine to answer that. So Dr. Pitt?
So I absolutely do. One of the things that I use Twitter for, and it went, I think, to one of the first questions, I think, you know, you can use these things for what you do and don't want. And my father's 73 years old. I signed him up to follow, like, 5 major national organizations, 10 journals, and like 5 national leaders, and that he doesn't follow much more than that. I mean, he's slowly grown. But to me, there are times if I haven't been on there a little while, I'll just look at the hashtag visual abstract. I get New England Journal and JAMA all just on my phone. I don't get anything hardly in print anymore. And I think that you have to be careful because the visual abstracts may not really tell the whole truth, but I think it's good to see those and at least go, oh, okay, so now I know, you know, this information's out there, and it helps me keep up on things outside my field of endocrine. I think a lot of things specifically within my field I still, you know, look at, but I personally find it very useful for that.
Dr. Todd, could you tell us, has that been a difference for you?
I'm really not on it at all, so I honestly don't.
But before you were, so.
You know, I mean, back then it wasn't quite as present in the professional realm. It was more social than anything. So, I mean, I can't see the utility in it, but I would tell you, you can get that same content other ways, so.
Well, just to give some historical content, there used to be a little red book that came out every month with a list of abstracts that you would actually read through. It was funny. Dr. Desanaka, you had a comment?
So I was just going to say, again, it's how you use it. But I don't do Twitter journal clubs. A lot of people love them. I just don't. It doesn't work for me, so I just don't participate. I will tell you, I have seen more breaking abstracts in fields that are not quite in my own, but just a little peripheral. You know, and these are really quite important papers. And diverticulitis, for example, the appendectomy antibiotic things. I saw it first on Twitter, and then you have to go, you really should go read the actual paper. But at least I'm alerted as soon as something hits the news. And especially because we're all busy, and we don't have time to read every journal that comes out in our field, especially if you have a large, broad-based field, it helps me stay current as to what I need to pay attention to. So for me, that's invaluable. It's my finger on the pulse of what everyone else in my field is talking about.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi, I'm Heather Loggy, and I'm in Reno, Nevada. I just wanted to offer a comparison of social media to food. There is healthy social media and useful social media, and there is unhealthy. And we could say that food is killing us, but no one's going to argue. I mean, no one's going to argue that it's not killing us, but we're also not going to do without it. And so being very mindful and setting boundaries, like you say. I mean, my 5-year-old daughter has a supervised Twitter account, and we were recently visited by her cardiologist friend from Australia. And they share koala tweets and kangaroos. And so it's very educational. So it's a lot about what you do with it and the choices you make.
No, I love that. I think that that's really a very important point. Do you have any recommendations for us as to how we could limit that? Because for me, just like 3 years ago, I've got a 24, a 21, and an 18-year-old, and 5 years ago we were sitting around the table, and I wanted to create a tool that would block Wi-Fi around our dinner table. Because, you know, they're sitting over here, and they're like, I'm not on my phone. You know, and it's just absolutely aggravating. And so do you have any suggestions?
I do have one. You know, one thing is that with the tools that we have now, there's not an endpoint. You used to read the newspaper, and you could read the newspaper, and you could feel done. You used to be able to watch your show once a week and feel done. And now there's no endpoints.
There's no done, right? Yeah.
And so realize that, like, that's, you know, where it's hard as a human since there's not that given endpoint.
Right.
And actually with my 5-year-old, actually when she was 2, she was setting the timer herself. And so she uses a timer to limit her time.
Yeah.
And I think as adults that can be useful too.
That's great, Dr. Pitt.
Yeah, so there are apps that are free that you can specifically do that for. I found my social media use was going a little out of control at times, and so my phone alarms at 10:30 at night if I touch it, and I can kick myself off of certain apps during certain times of the day. You know, you can have it do all sorts of different things that you want to do, so I think that there are
like
ways
acknowledging
to control
human
it
and setting those
if you can't parent yourself.
So maybe that's a topic for next year, how to limit social media. We might pick on you. Next question, please.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Will Tucker. I'm a medical student from Tennessee, and
thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you guys for putting on this panel. My question involves, I guess, not only can you magnify good with social media, but you can also magnify a lot of bad things. And I've even seen surgical residents, one in particular who in the past year has got an enormous Twitter presence and an enormous social media presence, and has kind of been a bad actor, I thought. And I was curious what you guys think and how you kind of combat that as an influence for good with
so you're talking about the Vanderbilt,
of course, right?
So very well known social media drama. So again, social media is just human society in a microcosm, right? There's nothing has changed. It's just instead of being in person, it's all of society now interacting. So if you're going to be a bad actor, it's the same rules. If you disparage people and lie and then harass people, yeah, there are consequences on social media as there are in real life. And to me, just like I said earlier, the only difference is now everybody knows about it. Whereas before, had that individual done what he had done in his institution, okay, so the people, those residents, those faculty, some med students, and their friends would know about it, you're limited to about one circle of influence. By doing this publicly on Twitter, he expanded that circle, first positively for him, he had a lot of following, and then that entire huge following of, he got, I think, close up to 30,000 followers, immediately turned on him when it was clear that he was doing some very unethical things. Or the point being, it's not the social media, all that's doing is amplifying it. It's not changing actually what was done. And I think, to me, that's the golden rule for everything you do. Whatever you do, it doesn't change. It's simply amplifying the number of people that know about it. That case, I think, was difficult for the institution that he came from. It was difficult to the institutions that he went to. I think it caused a lot more distress in a lot of people. But again, ultimately, it was just a fundamental point of amplification. The actual events were the actual events. At least that's
Rob,
my take on it.
Rob, did you have a comment?
Yeah, the one thing I would say, and I didn't put this slide up there, but there are some data out there also looking. The biggest difference, though, is it's not personal. I can sit here and type tons of stuff on my phone and send it out like that, and there's really no direct feedback. If I was going to sit there and tell you that to your face, probably wouldn't do it. I mean, I disagree a little bit, because I think people are much less apt to do it when you're sitting here having a conversation versus getting on my phone and just firing something off. And there are data on that also. I didn't bring that up, but
it's like breaking up by text, right? It's so much easier.
It's much easier.
next question.
Hi, I'm Drea Long from UCSF Fresno. I was tasked with starting our department's social media account, so I'm kind of starting from scratch. And the question I had for you is, you mentioned that find a way that you're going to handle patient comments and requests, but how do you guys handle both the positive and negative comments on the sites?
So let me ask Dr. Ghussani to answer that, please.
So, you know, I think with Facebook, most of the departmental pages are moderated, and so if somebody's saying something inflammatory or inappropriate, you can delete it. You can set settings so that it won't get posted unless you've looked at it and approved it, and so on. Our hospital does a pretty good job of alerting us if, you know, we're mentioned in a good way, and then telling us, you know, they won't put it up, but they'll tell us offline if something's mentioned in a bad way. I think that's a good sort of thing to try to implement. With regard to other platforms, it's very different. Twitter is open, it's free for all, so you have to be very careful. And people, you know, again, just like in real life, can say what they want, and maybe they're a little less inhibited, but you have to be just prepared for that and have to have a plan for how you're going to counteract that. And generally, you know, there's this kind of principle that you don't interact with the naysayers, the don't feed the trolls kind of thing. And it probably is a good idea. You know, a single lone negative voice or person who's disparaging you probably won't get a lot of traction. And you responding to them will give them a platform and traction. So that may be your approach.
So can I just add to that? So our physician's website for patients is just a very traditional website. So it really doesn't have options. There's a lot of places that have patients allowed to rate their physicians on the website. We haven't gone there. But there are places that have, and they've overall recorded good outcomes from it. So again, it's a personal choice. I'll tell you what we have, though. So our Facebook page that Dr. Ghassani highlighted is really more for what we do with our residents. It's not patient-centered for, you know, again, HIPAA reasons. We keep patients off there. But it was interesting. So we have a very diverse group, and I posted a picture of my graduating residents on Facebook. We do that every year. And one person said, oh, great, now teach them to speak English, because there were a lot of people there who were people of color. And they posted that on the Facebook site. So I actually had to deal with exactly that. So the person who manages it comes scurrying up to me and going, I should delete this, right? I should delete it. And I said, okay, let me think about this for a second. And I actually gave them a response. I decided, no, we're not going to delete it. I'm actually going to respond, because that does exist in the world, and these residents are going to face that. And I wanted to stand up for them. So I did give a very long response, and then a whole bunch of people piled on and said, yeah, you know, and basically told this hateful person, there was no other way to describe it, where to go. And we left it on for about a day, and then we took that comment and all the replies down and moved on. And so some of it you just have to navigate as you go.
So we've got just a couple of minutes, so two quick questions, please.
I'm Duncan Donald from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I have a question. You touched on this earlier about patients who send you friend requests on social media, and obviously there are some issues with patient boundaries there. But what about staff members, some of your coworkers, your surgical techs, your nurses that want to be friends with you on social media, and where do you set those boundaries with coworkers? Because that could lead to some issues at our hospital about favoritism and, oh, that's their favorite nurse, their favorite tech, and that type of issue.
Right, absolutely. So James, could you answer that?
Yeah, so I have that same issue. It's a personal boundary decision, and my Twitter profile, I maintain it really as my professional presence. My Facebook profile in years past has really been just for my personal friends who I would say that. Now, I do have personal friends that I work with. That's fine and great. And so those people I may request. Other people who are just acquaintances that are friend requesting me for one reason or another, I just don't accept it.
Okay,
very,
thank
very
you.
Very straightforward.
Next question. Sorry, last question.
Don Dilworth from San Antonio. Rob, I'm glad nobody had cameras back when we were drinking in med school and playing poker at Texas Tech. So, a little bit different. I'm in a private practice. I know most of you guys are in academics, but I'm in a private practice at a hospital system that's owned by Tenet. And basically, Tenet has come down with a policy that says we cannot have any social media related to the practice, anything like that. So I got a colorectal colleague down the hallway who's not employed, who's got poop emojis all over the internet. And I'm stuck with not being able to say anything, even on my Facebook account, about where I work. Anything in the future that is going to help us, you know, make them realize that this is an important marketing tool as well that people are using now.
So let me ask Dr. Ghassani.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the legality of, you know, some kind of ban like that, because theoretically, you know, you have a right of free speech and so on, and association or whatever you want to call it in terms of your social media. I think you have to be careful, right? You work for somebody who signs your checks, and there's no doubt that doing things contrary to their policies will get, you know, cause a problem for you. And I think it's a matter of trying to figure out which battles you want to fight, and whether this one is the right one for you. Depends on how it's affecting you, right? And we're probably at a point now where nobody can say that a lack of a professional social media profile is career suicide just yet. And so you might choose to not fight that battle, you know? And I don't know, I'm not suggesting that that's right, you know, that their policy is right. I'm just saying we all have to work and deal with those realities. So,
well, unfortunately, I know in the last month, they have allowed the hospitals now to have a Facebook site, which had never happened before. So hopefully they're starting to ease up.
Well, maybe you could just have a Bitmoji as your...
I mean, the one thing I'd say is that for any sophisticated business, a social media strategy is part of their business strategy. Yeah. And so, you know, if they're going to take the head in the sand approach, that's not a viable long-term option in today's digital world.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you to my co-moderator and all the speakers.